So as we normally do, we'll just start with a few brief words of introduction. So after the creational prologue, Genesis is divided into 10 toledot or generations headings. And so you have the prologue dealing with the origin of the world. And then you have 5 toledot that deal with the origins of the nations. And then you have 5 toledot that deal with the origins of Israel. And so the ones that deal with the origins of Israel, you have the generations of Terah, which tells the story of Abraham. You have the generations of Ishmael, the generations of Isaac, the generations of Esau, and then you have the generations of Jacob, which of course focuses on Joseph and on Judah. So, and we'll see how that focus is borne out as we work through the last words of Jacob in our time tonight. And so the 10th and final, so the generations of Jacob is the 10th and final section of Genesis, and it's found in chapters 37 through chapter 50. And so as we break that down a little bit, you have 37, you have division in the family, and Joseph is sold into slavery. And then in 38, you have Judah apart from his brothers, 39 through 41, you have Joseph apart from his brothers, and them. You have in 42 through 47, you have 3 journeys down to Egypt that bring the family back together again. And then in chapters 48 through 50, you have the passing of Jacob and the passing of Joseph. And so in chapter 48, you have Jacob's blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh. And 2 weeks ago, the last time that we were doing this, we talked about that blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh and how Jacob adopts Ephraim and Manasseh as two of the tribes of Israel. And then we dealt with everything but the last two verses that we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. And then in chapter 49, you have the passing of Jacob. And then in chapter 50, verses 1 through 14, you have Jacob is mourned and Jacob is buried. In 15 through 21, you have Joseph and his brothers. And then at the end of the chapter, you have the passing of Joseph. And so in chapter 48, verses 1 through 12, you have the adoption of Ephraim and Manasseh. Verses 13 through 20, you have a blessing for Ephraim and Manasseh. And then you have verses 21 and 22, a final gift for Joseph. So we have left those last two verses of 48, and then we'll dig into 49. We may not get through all of 49 tonight. Verse 21, and Israel said unto Joseph, behold, I die, but God shall be with you and bring you again into the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. As a quote from a commentator, he cannot say to Joseph, when you die, what father would? He hints at it and desires to say, when God brings our people to the land of our fathers and you, like me, want to be buried in the promised land, then here is a burial place for you. So it seems to be, I think that's probably correct. That seems to be what Israel is getting at, because remember, one of the issues in chapter 48, we talked about 2 weeks ago, is that there's a possibility Joseph is living apart from his father, and there seems to be this possibility, this danger, that Joseph is going to side with the Egyptians that he's living among. That's where he's going to pitch his lot. And Jacob, throughout this time, by adopting Ephraim and Manasseh, and really everything that he says in chapter 48, is pulling Joseph back in with the rest of his brothers, and that final cementing of the reuniting of the family. And so these last two verses are a final hint that Joseph, even when you die, here's a place for you to be buried, like I'm being buried, in the land of Canaan. And Joseph is in Joshua 24, 32. You have the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and it became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. So when Joseph dies in chapter 50, he's going to say, hey, when I die, you keep my bones in a box. And when you leave Egypt, you bring my bones to the land of Canaan and you bury me there. And he'll, in fact, be buried in Shechem. So that does seem to be what Jacob is getting at. The harder question is, what is he talking about when he says, verse 22 is very difficult. I've given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. And so one of the difficulties is understanding what portion means, because it's the word Shechem. It's the same, the place name Shechem. It's the same word. So it could be the place name. It could be something, you know, it could be a word that means something else. And so there's three basic ways of understanding what's going on here. So it could be a reference to a totally unknown event where Israel fights with the Canaanites, where Jacob fights with the Canaanites and takes a piece of property from them. However, almost everything else in these last chapters of Genesis are tying back to events that are recorded. So there are very, very few references to past events that take place within the time of Genesis that aren't actually recorded in Genesis. So that seems a little less likely. The problem is you have Genesis 33:18. So Jacob comes to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram, and pitched his tent before the city, and he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, 400 pieces of money. So it's a little bit confusing because it's a little bit confusing, so I'll try to make it as clear as I can. But the only property that Jacob is said to have owned in the land of Canaan is this field that he bought from the Shechemites. So that's the only property that he is said to have owned. And then when Joseph is buried in this property that his father gave to him, that property is in Shechem. And it repeats the story. I already read Joshua 24:32. It repeats the story that he bought this from the Shechemites. And this is the piece of property that Jacob was talking about. So then what is he talking about his sword and his bow? Because Jacob is about to condemn what Simeon and Levi did in destroying Shechem. If you recall, when Dinah was raped, Simeon and Levi had the Shechemites circumcise themselves. And then when they were incapacitated, they went and killed them all and took all of their stuff. And so Jacob had very negative words to say about their action, and he's about to condemn them for it once again. And so what is he talking about here? So it's possible that it could be a totally unknown event. I don't think that's the case. It possibly could be when he says, my sword and my bow, he's referring to Levi and Simeon, and they sort of conquered this territory, but by giving it to Joseph, he's keeping them from benefiting from their violence. So rather than that territory going to the violent ones, it's going to go to Joseph. That's possible. I think while no solution is perfect, what makes the most sense is that Jacob is making a pun, or not a pun, but sort of what he's saying is that his sword and his bow were the 100 pieces of silver. So he didn't need to violently, you know, destroy the Shechemites. He actually bought it, and his weapons with which he obtained the territory were his money. One of the reasons that might be a possibility is that when you go back to Genesis 33:18, and it says he bought it for 100 pieces of money, the word that is used for money there is unique to that passage, and it sounds a lot like the word that's translated as bow. So he bought it for a kasita, and bow is also a kasit, kasiti, but it sounds very similar in Hebrew. And so it could be he's making some sort of joke, and it seems clear. So to sum all of that up, that was a little bit confusing, but to sum all of it up, it seems clear One, he's referring back in some way to the piece of territory that he purchased from the Shechemites to hypothesize some event that we don't know about seems less likely. And two, in some way, he is either referring to what Levi and Simeon did and dispossessing them from that and saying, I'm going to give it to Joseph instead. Or he's making a pun and saying that his sword and his bow were the pieces of money that he bought it from. I know that was a little bit confusing, but hopefully we'll be able to make some progress with the rest of it. So Genesis 49 is the first long poem in the Bible, and it is a little bit difficult to understand. It's full of obscure puns, historical difficulties, words that appear only here or whose meaning is highly debated in this context. And yet there are a number of difficulties. There are some precious treasures here as well. So the overall structure, you have first the sons of Leah are mentioned. So you have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and then you have Zebulun and Issachar. And the order of Zebulun and Issachar are reversed. So in Genesis 29 through 30, Zebulun and Issachar was born first. Zebulun was born after. That order is switched here in Genesis 49. So first you have the sons of Leah. Then you have the sons of the concubines. You have four sons by the concubines. But the four sons by the concubines, rather than having them, so in the historical order, Bilhah has both of her sons, who was Rachel's handmaid. So Rachel's handmaid gives birth to two sons. And then Leah's handmaid gives birth to two sons. But rather than keeping that order, here in Genesis 49, you have Bilhah and then Zilpah, Zilpah and then Bilhah. So it's rearranged the order there. And then it finishes with the... It finishes with the...
Watch out.
All right. I think there's someone else that needs to be muted. All right. Are we good now? All right. For some reason, I was ending up muted. So you have... the sons of Leah, and then you have the sons of the concubine. They're in a different order than Genesis 29 through 30, which tells the birth of the tribes. And then you have the sons of Rachel. So in this overall testament of Jacob to his sons, you have four sons that get singled out for special discussion. So most of these blessings are very, very brief and very obscure, but there's four that are more detailed. And one of the most fascinating things that I found as I was preparing for this is that there are four sons whose name is explained by reference to the Lord in Genesis 29 through 30. It's those four sons that in the narrative from Genesis 30 through Genesis 50 take sort of precedent in the story. So they're the ones that take the lead in the story. And they're the ones who are given the most detailed blessing here. So if you were paying really careful attention in Genesis 29 and 30, you would be able to tell in advance who are the sons that the narrative is going to focus on. So, of course, those four are Reuben. So Leah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, surely the Lord hath looked upon my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me. And Reuben means, look, a son. So that's the firstborn. And that's explained by reference to the name of the Lord. So the Lord has looked upon me. So Leah mentions the Lord in Reuben's name. And then Simeon, who was her secondborn, and she conceived again and bare a son and said, because the Lord hath heard that I was hated, he has therefore given me this son also. And she called his name Simeon. So Simeon's name, so whereas Reuben's name means, look, there's a son, the Lord has looked upon me. Simeon's name makes a reference to the idea that the Lord has heard Leah. And of course, Simeon is given detailed treatment in this blessing, as we're about to find out. And then the third one who's mentioned with reference to the name of the Lord is Judah. And she conceived again and bare a son. And she said, now will I praise the Lord. Therefore, she called his name Judah and left bearing. And of course, Judah gets the second longest blessing. And Judah's name sounds like the word that's translated as praise. And then the fourth one who's referenced with the name of the Lord is Joseph in Genesis 30. And she, that is Rachel, conceived and bare a son and said, God hath taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another son. So Joseph's name is closely connected both to the verb translated as taken away and the one translated as add, thus representing both Rachel's delight in the end of her barrenness and her longing for further fruitfulness. And these are the four that the Lord's name is mentioned, and these are the four that are prominent in the story, and these are the four names that then become prominent in the blessing or the last testament of Jacob, where he tells his sons what's going to happen to them. So there's this sort of internal consistency to the book of Genesis and to the materials that have that have been put together in this story. So everything sort of fits together. And so if you're, you know, paying careful attention, you can see these hints even before they're fully developed. Any questions about anything that we've covered up to this point? Any questions or comments about anything we've gone up to this point? All right, we'll go ahead and move on then. So Genesis 49:1, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the latter days. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. So while Jacob had had a meeting with Joseph because he was going to adopt Ephraim and Manasseh, when Jacob gives his final benediction, his final blessing, he calls all of his sons together. And you remember, this is something that we commented on a long time ago now, when we talked about how Isaac tried to give the blessing to Esau instead of to Jacob, that he was trying to do this sort of private blessing with just Esau when he should have been calling Esau and Jacob together. That was the right way to do it. And now that Jacob is on his deathbed, Jacob is going to do it the right way. He's going to call all of his sons, the good, the bad, the ugly, and everywhere in between. He's going to call them all together, and he's going to give, he's going to tell them what is going to happen to them in the last days. On this phrase, often translated as the latter days, in the prophets, it becomes, particularly in Isaiah and in Jeremiah, it becomes a technical term for the last days, for the end of time, for sort of the eschatological future that is coming. It doesn't have to mean that. And here, it just means this is what's going to happen to you a long time from now. Though when we get to the blessing of Judah, there is a hint of that eschatological blessing, that last days, end times blessing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this is telling all the tribes what's going to happen to them at the very end. It just means something that's going to happen a long time from now. And he says, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. So using both of his names. And in fact, in this section, Jacob appears five times and Israel appears five times. So there's this balance between the two standard names for Israel. And so that's the frame that it starts out with. He gathers his sons together, and he starts telling them what's going to happen. Now, some of these are blessings, some of these are more like curses, and some of them are predictions that it's difficult to tell whether they're good or bad. And so often it might be, rather than the last blessing of Jacob, maybe the testament or the last words of Jacob. So we begin with Reuben, who is found in 49 verses 3 through 4. Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. Because thou wentest up to my father's bed, thou defilest it. Then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch. And so Reuben is unstable, or another way to translate that word would be to say that Reuben is unrestrained. So like water that doesn't stay in its channel, but just goes up wherever it wants and it floods and nothing is holding it in. That's the picture of what Reuben's character is like. And we're going to come back to this in a minute. He says, you are unstable. You are unrestrained. You don't stay in the proper boundaries. And therefore, you are not going to excel. So there's a wordplay here that is captured well in English, and it's in Hebrew as well. You have, you're my firstborn. He was the beginning of Jacob's strength. And he says, excellent of dignity and excellent of power. He was someone who had everything going for him. So he had everything that was necessary to excel, and yet, because of his character flaw, because he was not restrained, because he did not have self-control, even though he was the one who excelled in dignity and power, he was not going to excel in the end. And so it's a wordplay between the beginning of verse 3 and the second half, or the beginning of verse 3 and verse 4. And a man, as one commentator pointed out, who could not control himself was not fit to control others. And if you follow the story of the Reubenite tribe, because these blessings, these predictions are not just for the individuals, but Jacob is predicting what's going to happen to the tribes over the long haul of the history of Israel. And the only notable people from the Reubenites, does anyone know? I didn't know until I looked it up, but does anyone know the only notable leaders from the Reubenite tribe? They're not good. There's only one or two notable Reubenites. Now, Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. So the only Reubenites who ever did anything prominent that we have record of are Dathan and Abiram, who challenge Moses and end up being destroyed. So apart from Dathan and Abiram, no prophet, no judge, no king, no one of any significance, no one who excelled came from the tribe of Reuben. So it wasn't just that Reuben didn't excel, but Reuben's descendants, they never took the prominence that should rightfully have been theirs. And of course, in Reuben's past history, which Jacob goes on to remind him and his other sons of, he says, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defiledest thou it. And then it seems as if he turns from speaking to Reuben and sort of points to Reuben and looks at his other sons and says, he went up to my couch. And the backstory there is Genesis 35:22. And it came to pass when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard it. And so Bilhah was Rachel's servant, Jacob's concubine. And for whatever reason, So Bilhah was not Reuben's mother, but she was Jacob's wife, and Reuben decided to take advantage of her and defile his father's bed, and that is why he had no control. He did something that was evil, and his father knew about it. It's only now in Genesis 49 that Jacob gets around to responding, and when he does, his words are words of harsh condemnation. And basically, he tells Reuben, you had everything going for you, but you refused to control yourself. And because of that, nothing is going to turn out well for you or for your descendants. And it's somewhat of a dark and difficult story, but I think it has a tremendous practical application to us that I'm going to share as our first application question here. As the example of Reuben illustrates, no amount of talent or strength can make up for a lack of self-restraint. What are some areas where we might be tempted to tolerate a lack of self-control? So some examples would be, you know, lack of self-control at the table. So gluttony, where we don't control our appetites, or binge watching, where we don't control our entertainment, or venting, where we don't control our frustration, or excessive drinking, alcohol is not, is imbibed, and it's not imbibed moderately, but it's imbibed to excess, and there's a lack of control in that respect, or slothfulness when there's a lack of self-control regarding sleep. Christy Tanaka commented shopping. That could certainly be the case where we have materialism that we just buy and buy and buy, and we don't control how much we spend, and either we just spend all the money we have, or maybe even money we don't have. And the, you know, amount of credit card debt that American families have is astonishing because of a lack of self-control. And Christy also mentioned your phone and just constantly browsing social media because it's like eye candy and it's easy. I think that's a real relevant one. Elisha mentioned not pushing ourselves to work harder. And I think that that could be a little bit of a different thing, but it could be a lack of self-control where there's distractions from work. I mean, we see this, you know, all around, that the productivity sometimes is not what it should be, because rather than focusing on the task, people get a notification on social media, and even though they're being paid to do one thing, they spend their time doing something else because of a lack of self-control, and they don't Braylon and Hannah, our jobs, I think that could be taken, you know, in a lot of ways, either not controlling ourselves in terms of focusing on the task, or so focusing on the task that we don't balance other areas of life and we don't discipline ourselves to give the effort that work requires, but not maybe more than it requires, because maybe we need to save some energy for our families or for other things in life as well. Those are all good. Those are all good areas. Anyone else? Any other comments or questions or observations about that?
Nate Axel has a comment.
How about it with your temper?
Yes, absolutely. Anger. I think that's totally, you know, where people can have everything going for them, but they don't hold their temper. And they can destroy in a few seconds credibility and connections that they may have spent months or even years or in some cases even decades building up. Anyone else? Airing our opinions without listening first, that we have something that we just want to say. So Lori commented on Christy's, there we go. So Lori's the one who said it, just airing our opinions without listening because we want to be heard and we don't want to listen. I think that's true too. I mean, a lack of self-control can show up in any area of life and it can really be just tremendously destructive. Anyone else before we move on? Brother John, Pastor John.
There we go. Trying to figure out how to raise my hand on the little screen, the blue hand. I couldn't figure it out. Anyway, I think in the digital age, I think it's really easy to become more and more a more and more lack of self-control, just because you have that veil of anonymity. Where you're behind a screen, you can go onto Facebook, you can blast people, or you can send text messages, emails, things where you don't have to be face-to-face, and you can, like you're talking about venting, you could vent easily, more easily that way, perhaps, in the digital age than perhaps we did before.
I think even with some forms of, you know, when you're face-to-face with someone, there's a certain amount of restraint that sometimes you'll temper your tongue because you can see the impact that your words are having. But when you're just texting a message and you're sending it off, sometimes you can end up being much sharper and much less controlled than you would be were you there, because you're not experiencing the impact that your words are having, but your words could still be having just as much or even more impact. And so that's something. Ashley commented, being sloppy, hoping your talents get you through. So, I mean, that's the story of Ruben. He's someone who has all these ability. He has all these talents and all this opportunity, and he throws it all away, and his life just runs out like sand through your fingers. And that's the story, not just of Ruben, but of many, many people throughout history. And I think, you know, like Pastor John was saying, just the technologies that we have today are making it easier and easier to let our lives slip through our hands because of a total lack of self-control. Anyone else? This is good discussion.
Hey, Peter. I just unmuted myself. Can you hear me?
Yep.
So I just want to share the strikes really close to my heart with the way God saved me and, you know, the rationale in my life before salvation was very much the exact same rationale that you kind of juxtaposed there with, hey, don't I do all these great things and am I not talented in all these different ways, and doesn't that balance out these little areas of lack of self-control, which snowballed obviously and completely destroyed my life? And that's the terrifying reality of any sin, and lack of self-control certainly is that once you've rationalized it in a small way, you know, once sin has gotten this hook in you, you get control the way that it takes over your life. And I just want to share, like, that's literally one of the great, you know, pulling the blinders back and realizing that any sin whatsoever, you know, basically that rationale is toxic and dangerous. And it touches close to my heart, and I appreciate you bringing that analogy, and obviously the different in each person. But I think that rationale, you calling that out, is deeply convicting to me and a reminder of what God has saved me from. So thanks.
Thank you. Deborah commented how we spend our time spending it selfishly. So a lack of control, that we just spend time on what we want to spend it on, instead of maybe apportioning it to the responsibilities that we have. Brother Berger commented, with our family, we can say or do things to them without a thought, but we'd stop and think with others that sometimes a lack of self-control shows up more at home, that we may feel like we need to keep it all put together when we're out at our job or maybe even at church. But at home, our tempers flare and we say things without controlling it. This often can be, we maintain a front of control, but we actually are not controlling ourselves in the consistent way that's necessary. Anyone else before we move on? Going once, going twice. All right. Well, now we come to Simeon. And Simeon and Levi are the only two that are dealt together. So Simeon and Levi receive a joint, it's not really a blessing, it's more of a condemnation. So they receive a joint condemnation. And it's actually interesting. So Levi doesn't have one of those, the Lord, the explanations of his name that means that goes back to the name of the Lord. Simeon is the one who has that. But when Leah has Levi, she says, now my husband is going to be joined to me. But instead of Jacob being joined to Leah, Levi and Simeon are joined together in misdeeds. And so you have in Genesis 49:5, Simeon and Levi are brethren, and of course they were brothers. They both had the same mother and the same father, but that was the case for all six of Leah's sons. But they were joined together in their violence against the Shechemites. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly, mine honor be not thou united. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. The backstory here, of course, is Genesis 34. And it came to pass on the third day, so Simeon and Levi had tricked the Shechemites into circumcising themselves. And here was what they did. It came to pass on the third day, when they were sore, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword, and it came upon the city boldly, slew all the males, they steal all the cattle, they take all the captives, and they leave. And there's a number of grammatical and puzzles in these verses that I'm only going to deal with one of them. You have this: in their anger, they slew a man, and in their self-will, they dig down a wall. Now, a literal reading of the Hebrew as it stands would be, in their anger, they killed a man, and in their willfulness, or self-will, they hamstrung an oxen. And so the Hebrew, as it's pointed in the Masoretic text, you have this parallel between a human being that they kill and an ox that they hamstring. Now, the problem is that in the story, if you read the rest of Genesis 34, they don't hamstring an oxen. Now, hamstringing or hawking an ox or a horse involves the practice of provoking paralysis by cutting the tendons of the leg in order to prevent the animal from being used as a beast of burden. And so it doesn't kill the animal, but it lames the animal by nicking just ever so slightly or cutting their hamstring. They become useless. They can't pull, they can't run, they can't draw chariots. And so this is something you would do when you couldn't dispose of all of the carcasses of the animals. You could make them useless to the enemy just by giving a little nick to their hamstring. So for you Sherlock Holmes fans out there, it was something analogous to this, that in the story of Silver Blaze, that the evil trainer was going to put a tiny little nick in the racehorse's hamstrings so that he would still be able to run but not have any possibility of finishing the race anywhere close to the start, because he was the favorite. And so by laming him, it would be he would be able to bet a lot of money against his own horse and make out like a bandit. But that wasn't what happened. If you can read the story, and I'll stop the Sherlock Holmes diversion. But the way you would normally read this is if they hamstring an ox. But in the story, that's not what they do to the oxen. So what the King James has done is slightly repointed the Hebrew text to have, so shore would be ox, shore would be shore with a more of a U sound would be a wall. So even though the story doesn't say anything about tearing a wall down, it could be they killed the people and they destroyed the wall. Another way of looking at it that I think is a little more likely is that the idea of an ox is used sort of metaphorically, and it's parallel to man. So they killed men, but they also, before they killed them, they lamed them. They put them in a sort of paralysis so they wouldn't be able to fight. And so it could be a way of alluding to their circumcision of the Shechemites that kept them from being able to fight. So the Shechemites would be the reference of the ox. And there's like three or four other ways of interpreting this line, but I'll spare you. Those are the two that, so either it's referring to a wall and they broke the wall of Shechem down, or I think more likely it's alluding to the Shechemites themselves, who they killed, but before they killed them, they lamed them. And so they wouldn't be able to fight back. So moving to a more general application, I think it's important to recognize, you know, if you go back to the story, Jacob's total failure to respond to the assault on his daughter is not presented in the story as a good thing. So Jacob's response was wrong. And Simeon and Levi were right to be upset and were even right to seek restitution for Dinah. But what's clear is that in their anger, in their zeal about being right when their father was wrong, their anger knew no boundaries. They were so convinced of their own, the rightness of their own cause, that they didn't just destroy the guilty, they destroyed the innocent along with the guilty. they didn't just go after the culprit. They took out the whole city and enslaved all of the women and enslaved all of the children and took all of their stuff. They didn't have boundaries to their anger. So in some ways, they were very similar to Reuben. And I think it's important to recognize that anger, even righteous anger, can be incredibly destructive if we give vent to it. James 1:19 says, "Wherefore, of my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." There are times when anger is appropriate, but anger itself doesn't work the righteousness of God. We need to always place boundaries on our anger by what is actually just, not just what feels to us appropriate in the heat of our rage. And so the fate of Simeon and Levi was that they would be scattered in Israel. And that is, in fact, what happened to them. So if you go to the two censuses in the book of Numbers, you have in Numbers 1:23, those that were numbered of them, even of the tribe of Simeon, were 59,300. And when you go to the second census, they are all the way down to 22,200. And so well over half of the descendants of Simeon disappear in the wilderness wanderings, and they go from being one of the largest of tribes to being one of the smallest of tribes. And when you get to Joshua 19:1, you find this: "And the second lot came forth to Simeon, even for the tribe of the children of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was within the inheritance of the children of Judah." And so the tribe of Simeon becomes absorbed into the tribe of Judah, and Simeon doesn't have a distinct inheritance among their own. They're mingled with the other tribes. And of course, the Levites, as most of you will be aware, they weren't given a tribal inheritance at all, but instead they were given 48 cities that were all through the tribes of Israel, and they served to take care of the tabernacle, and they served as judges in other ways. So they were divided and scattered in Israel, just as Jacob had predicted. Now, are there any questions or comments up to this point? Any discussion?
Go ahead, Nate.
Hey, Pastor Peter, you said Simeon was absorbed into Judah. Does that mean that the lineage wasn't paid attention to anymore? Did they consider themselves a distinct tribe still?
You know, I suspect they probably still would have considered themselves as a distinct tribe. So it's not so much that, because the Levites were a distinct tribe as well, but in terms of their inheritance, they were, they were scattered and divided. So I don't think they would have not kept genealogical records in that way. But the idea is that they're divided and they're scattered and they don't have the unity and the prominence that the other tribes have.
Because Judah definitely kept the state, right? I mean, to maintain the messianic line.
Yeah. So I think it's more about their, where they are geographically than sort of an ethnic line being mingled. So it's that they're scattered, not that they're, so I may have misspoke that. It's not so much that they're mingled, because the Levites were a distinct tribe, even though they were scattered from one end of the land to the other. So so Simeon is a little less clear, but their inheritance, they still didn't have that distinct inheritance of their own. They at least geographically, were assimilated into the tribe of Judah. Does that make sense?
Yep, absolutely.
Christy Tanaka commented, "I think it was good that Simeon and Levi," this is Bethany on Christy's. So Bethany said, "I think it was good that Simeon and Levi tried to vindicate their sister when Jacob wouldn't, but it's a good point about having boundaries with our anger." And Stephanie asked, "So is it okay to show your anger, or should you suppress your anger and not let it show?" Well, you know, I think that a good example for us in this respect, as in every respect, is Jesus, that his anger at the perversion of temple worship was real. and he let that anger show, and that anger resulted in real action. And yet, if you look at careful detail at what Jesus did in the temple, all of his actions were actions that had boundaries. So he turned over the tables of the money changers, but the money could be picked back up again. He didn't take the money and dump it in the bottom of the sea. You know, he drove out the oxen, but they could be regathered. It wasn't like he went through just killing all the animals and slaughtering people in this fierce, overwhelming rage. Everything he did was appropriate, and specifically appropriate to the people he was exercising judgment on. So he was very angry, but he was angry in a way that wasn't boundless. I think one of the things we need to remember, you know, when in the Old Testament you have an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, the point is not, I'm going to go get my pound of flesh. The point is, well, what revenge wants to do is revenge always wants to get one more. Well, you did this to me? Just wait till I get started on you, because I'm, you know, I mean, an example, you know, you think it's, well, okay. I will exercise self-control and not give any number of political examples that are coming to mind right now of the past couple of weeks. But the idea is that you did this to me. Well, just wait till I get my revenge on you, because it's going to be 10 times more. That's the spirit that Simeon and Levi have. And that's what's prohibited by saying punishment has to fit the crime. It needs to be appropriate and not be excessive. And that same principle that we have in the law in terms of judicial punishment is the principle that we should apply to our own anger. That anger should be appropriate to what's actually taking place and not just overpass in boundless rage. It should always be tempered with justice, tempered with mercy, tempered with a knowledge of what's actually taking place, with patience and appropriateness. And so sometimes anger is needed, but anger should never be without limits, without boundaries, without self-control. Anyone else? This is good discussion. Looks like Pastor John is going to say something. Is that the case? Well, I'll let you two sort that out, and I'll read what Lori wrote here. In the unlikely event of a person acting in true righteous anger, can you give an example of what that might look like? Well, I mean, I think what we should be angered by, I don't think it's unlikely at all. I think, you know, we should be angered by sin. You know, we should, like, abortion, for instance, is something that should make us angry. If you're not angered by the murder of unborn children, there's something wrong with you. But that doesn't mean you should therefore go up and blow up abortion clinics. That would be the sort of approach that Simeon and Levi had, which was one that was deeply counterproductive and didn't produce justice at all. So I think that's, you know, that balance of being angered. I think, you know, an angry face, there's a proverb about this that, an angry countenance drives away a backbiting tongue. Did I say that right? It's close. Something like that. I think with our children, there's never times for boundless anger, but there are times when your children need to see that their rebellion has made you angry, because that will often keep them from continuing to, you don't discipline in anger, but if you're never angry, then I think that's a lack of balance on the other side, that you don't want to be wrathful where you have no control, but it's appropriate to be upset when they're doing something that's going to cause grave harm to them in the future. And that's, I think, appropriate and sometimes even necessary. I'm going to look up that proverb I mentioned. There we go. the north wind driveth away rain, so doth an angry countenance, a backbiting tongue. And I think sometimes there's an appropriate place for an angry countenance when someone has done something that is wrong. But again, that anger needs to be controlled. Bill Berger commented, a disappointing anger, not a revengeful anger. That is absolutely the case. And the reference for the proverb is Proverbs 25:23. Anyone else before we wrap up? Well, let's go ahead and close with a word of prayer. And thank you all for participating. And we will be, the next time we come together on this, we will be dealing with Judah. And of course, that's one of the more interesting of the oracles. Father, I come before you and I thank you for this time. I thank you for your blessing on us. I pray you'd help us to glorify you. Help us to not just hear your word, but to be doers of the word, to take the things that we've learned and apply them in our lives. I thank you for your goodness to us. In Christ's name I pray. Amen.